We have discussed the experiences that occur during the death process, where the mind ends up in its most subtle aspect, that we call the clear light mind, which is the final vision of death. Still not dead. Death actually occurs when the indestructible drop separates, and the eternal drop, the most subtle wind of mind, just separates from the old body. And then instantaneously, as the result of the karma or collection of karmas which ripened during death to determine the future life, the effect of those karmas is that the clear light vision stops and the winds start to become more coarse as the mind becomes more coarse. So there's quite rapidly the experience of the visions in reverse. There's black vision, there's a red vision, white vision, and then instantaneously one is awake as a Bardo being. Bardo, the intermediate state. And so it's said that the clear light mind is the primary cause for the Bardo being's mind, and the clear light wind is a secondary condition for the Bardo being's mind. The clear light wind is the primary cause for the Bardo being's body, and that clear light mind is the secondary condition for the Bardo being's body. So, for example, if human karma had ripened, you know, the karma to be born human, then that karma causes a human type consciousness and mind to arise in the Bardo. And the wind, remember, that one entity, two functions, awareness, mind, movement, wind. So that becomes the Bardo being's body and mind. So it is the karma ripens in terms of affecting the mind, and so the mind determines that the Bardo body is a human type Bardo body. So in the Abhidharma it says, karma to be born human, then the Bardo being's body is like shaped like a human, and it is about the size of a six-year-old child. Just the size, not the aspect, but the size of a six-year-old child. And so the Bardo being has all six consciousness possibility. It has a basis for eye, ear, smell, taste, touch consciousness, and the mental consciousness. So it's very much like waking up in a dream. You know, we go to sleep, mind becomes very quiet, and then we emerge in a dream. Sometimes in a body similar to our waking body, sometimes quite different. You know, dreams are very, very different. But the dream experience is coming from the mind. And the things that we experience come from the mind. They're not real. You know, we dream of elephants or whatever, aren't real elephants. But in the dream, they appear as real and they seem to function as real for the dream body, for the dream mind. Okay. The Bardo being has clairvoyant powers inasmuch as wherever it thinks, it automatically, you know, you think of a particular region, then it arrives at that region. So it can be quite variable what happens. Just as dreams are influenced so much by our state of mind when we go to sleep, the Bardo experience is quite different, dependent upon such a variety of conditions in the mind. it's said in some in the teaching that some Buddha beings, because of attachment to the family, they can see the old body, and like they can be at their funeral, and they can see the relatives crying and so on, and they're aware, and they try to communicate, but they don't have the capacity to communicate with their relatives. Then they might think of somewhere else, and they're gone. They go to wherever they think of. So, as in dreams, we can change the set of our dream quite rapidly, one to another, just by changing our mind. So this is part of the Bardo experience. I once attended a seminar at Sydney University in Australia, and the seminar was entitled something like The Death Experience. And there were different speakers from different fields of study, not all religious or Buddhist. There were scientists with theories of what happens. It's quite an interesting seminar. I virtually talked about what I've talked to you so far. There's one presenter from England who showed a video taken of a girl in England, and the story was that this girl, when she was very young, maybe three or 4 years old, she was with her parents, and they were driving past a village in England, a country village, and she said to her parents, "Look, Mummy, there's the place where I was buried when I died." And Mother said, "What are you talking about?" And the girl's name was Alice. And the mother previously had another husband who'd had a baby called Alice who had died. And this little girl had never been told the story, but they had actually lived in that village, and that was where the other girl had been buried. And the little girl went on, she said, "No, it wasn't me, Mummy, it was Alice number one. I'm Alice number two. And you were there, and I was lying in the box, in the coffin, and I had my favourite doll in the coffin, and you were standing around and crying, and everybody was crying. And so, Mummy, I just wished that I could be your baby again." So they sort of went past the village, and later they asked the little girl more, and there's even a time the video showed the girl under hypnosis. Now, under hypnosis, she went back to that time, and that was when she was describing what was in the coffin. Now, the mother had checked out. She hadn't put the doll in the coffin, and she was sure it wasn't there. But when she told the story to her sister, the sister said, "Oh, I put it there." So unknown to the mother, and definitely unknown to Alice number two, the little doll was in the coffin and buried with her. So it was a very moving sort of video, and during the video, when she was under hypnosis, she was describing Alice number two was describing it, and she said, "I wanted to be my mummy's baby again, and I knew that this time, next time, or this time, my daddy wouldn't hurt me when I'm in my mother's womb or in her tummy." At that point, the mother was in the background of the video and she started crying. So she explained afterwards that her previous husband, the father of Alice number one, had actually beaten her when she was pregnant with Alice number one and had caused physical injury to the unborn baby. I don't think that was the cause of the death, but that had happened. And Alice number two had no idea. But of course since then she'd remarried, she divorced that man and remarried another man and then became pregnant again. So, I just repeat that talk that I witnessed at the university, and it ties in very much with the Buddhist explanation of the Bardo existence, that you can be aware of other people to whom you're attached to, so be close to the environment of your past death, and through wish and through karma, which you didn't know about karma, but we can be reborn again, even to the same family. So very often we might be our own great grandparents, you know, and we might become our own great grandchildren. Hypothetically or speculating, there is this possibility of individuals being reborn in the same family through attachment. Of course, not necessarily, because we all die under different circumstances, and I think the norm is that we just go everywhere else and according to our karma, according to our mind, and born in other places. But that was just sharing that story. So in the notes we mentioned the Abhidhamma Kosha. This is a book on the Abhidhamma, a commentary written by the great scholar Vasubandhu. So it's in that text, it says that the future birth is irreversible. Your karma has ripened to be human, animal, whatever, and you will, in the Bardo, you will connect with a future rebirth in that particular state. Tantric practices can change, but for most of us, we aren't capable of doing those practices. We have mentioned that there are three realms of rebirth: the desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm. Desire realm is realms of rebirth, hells, hungry ghosts, animal, human; desire realm, gods. So the dominant mental attachment is to sensory pleasure, creates a rebirth there. Form and formless realm, the cause is attachment to the mental experience of meditative absorption or concentration. So you reach a level of mental concentration, you like it, you create karma to be reborn in a similar situation after death. So if your karma has risen to be born in the desire realm, the Bardo being is now physically nourished by odors, like pleasant odors, if you're going to have a happy rebirth; unpleasant odors, unhappy rebirth. The duration of life in the Bardo is indefinite. Some texts say that through karma, one is attracted to one's place of rebirth. But if it hasn't happened in 7 days, the Bardo being experiences a mini-death experience, like down to the clear light and then back again, but still in the Bardo, and still the same karma. And that can happen maximum 7 times. So in the vast majority of cases, after 7 weeks, the mind of the person who has died will have taken rebirth according to their karma. Rare occasions, it says that beings can remain even longer in the Bardo, but not forever. Eventually, one will be reborn. I mentioned yesterday that not only is our form, our type of rebirth, determined by karma, whether we're human, animal, whatever, but also our lifespan and our gender. So this is an interesting point, particularly in this day and age when there are a lot of questions about gender, when it appears that there are some people and children who psychologically identify and feel very strongly that they are the opposite gender of their body. Like they want to convince they're a little boy or a little girl when their bodies are the opposite. And there's, well, we don't know what's going on. And this isn't, I don't think it's a new phenomenon. I think it's always been in human society, this gender confusion between our psychological gender and our physical gender. And there are all sorts of circumstances, social and environmental, which can influence such thoughts. But it's just, when I think about it, then if our gender is determined by karma, then that must be our psychological gender. Now, of course, we've all been both male and female. We've been either male or female, countless times in the past. We're not always male or always female. We've had every type of rebirth. So it seems to me that if gender is determined by karma, it must be the psychological gender. Like one has a greater affinity for masculine or feminine qualities in the mind. Human, because we're talking about human karma, so human, masculine, human, feminine, psychological qualities. And they are not exactly the same. When I was a medical student and having a succession of different girlfriends, I remember thinking, wow, when I become a doctor, I'll become a psychologist, and I'll write a book about psychology, and one will be male psychology and the other will be female psychology, and that will be different. That's as a medical student, knowing nothing about Buddhism. So it's described that not in every case, but if human rebirth has the karma has ripened, then if you have the karma to be male, you have a vision. The Buddha being has a vision of the future parents engaging in sexual activity. And if you're going to be male, there's a sense of desire, physical desire for the future mother, and aversion, anger towards the future father. And if you're going to be karmic ripening to be female, there is physical desire towards the future father and animosity towards the future mother. The desire attracts the Buddha being almost uncontrollably towards the union of the sex organs, and the animosity, the aggression, causes the Buddha being to experience the death process. So this uncontrollable compulsion, attraction to the union, and then dying, so the mind goes down to the clear light, and so eternal drop manifests again, and that enters the ovum or the egg, the future mother, round about the time of conception. Exactly when, I'm not sure, but close to the time of conception. Now, whether that conceived, what do we say? Forget the term. Whether the embryo has two X chromosomes or two Y, or an X and a Y chromosome, that determines whether the body will be female or male. From my point of view, this isn't Dharma teaching. From my point of view, I think that's chance. I don't think it's karma. I think it's 50-50. Now, because we've all been male and female in past lives, every new human has both masculine and feminine qualities in their mind. In fact, the spiritual path, according to the completion of the Tantra, the Vajrayana, is to manifest both our masculine and feminine qualities and bring them to perfection in the mind. So, most cases, if by chance, karmically, we had a tendency to be born, karmically, we had the cause to be born, say, female, but we ended up with a male body, then we'll adapt and probably live as a male, or we may have different tendencies. So whole social factors come into play. Now, what happens? And when we look, you know, there are those few children who strongly identify with a different psychological gender than their physical gender, I think this would be a reasonable explanation of what's going on. And so how we deal with it, well, that's up to society and how they deal with it. But we can, the best thing for dealing with it is understanding what's going on. And I think a lot of problems with intersex people and people want to change is first parents reject, or they feel guilty, oh, I did something wrong, or total rejection, and there's a lot of, you know, really difficult problems arise, not only from within the family, but in society in general. So if we looked at it from this point of view, we should be more relaxed and also, we should teach everybody to be free from the belief that they're inherently existing male, or inherently existing female, or inherently existing attractive, inherently existing unattractive, and so on. This is the big problem. That we're, our body, our minds in particular, they're not inherently existing. Yeah, our bodies are genetically male or female, that's pretty straightforward. But our minds are not. Everything is changeable. So that should, I hope, just understanding that, should relieve the pressure, the social pressure on individuals who feel different, as well as their personal, you know, self-consciousness. I am different, I am bad, you know, which is wrong. It could alleviate the intensity of feeling bad or whatever. Okay. Of course, Sigmund Freud, he called it the Oedipus complex, didn't he? He recognized that young boys do have a physical attraction towards their mother and hostility towards their father. And he called it the Oedipus complex. And later, Carl Jung, who was a colleague or a student of Freud, he recognized the same thing in females. Physical attraction to the father and antagonism towards the mother. And he called it the Electra complex, which is again from the Greek stories and Greek gods and so on. So these psychological tendencies are verified in you know, psychology as being evident present in once free birth has been taken. That's quite interesting to look at the dynamics of our mind. How it's very, very interesting from my point of view. Anyway, so now what happens in the sperm and the ovum from mother and dad? There is the white drop from this and the red drop. Mother, and these form a capsule, and that's in this fertilized egg. Just one fertilized egg has the eternal drop and the indestructible drop and the eternal drop inside. Then immediately after conception, the karma is ripening again, just as We went down to the clear light of death and then reversed into the Bardo body and mind. Similarly, at the actual rebirth, down to the clear light, and then conception, and then emerging from that karma, the result of that karma. So immediately, due to karma, the mind becomes coarse and its supporting winds become coarse. And it's described in the textbooks, particularly on Tibetan medicine. Well, I've read it. This information is coming from Tibetan medical textbooks. That the coarser winds, the clear light wind and mind remain in the instructional drop, but through the white substance there is the coarser or coarsening winds start to come, and from the red drop coarsening winds start to emerge. And as this happens, this is very quick, the embryo experiences the black, red and white visions, and then becoming more and more alert over time. So the movement of the winds in these two directions, through the, they carry white drop substance and red drop substance, and this is the formation of the central channel. So where the indestructible drop is, that will be the future heart chakra. And so you get this elongation and formation of the channels, the coarsening winds, and then the other chakras and the branching. And this is interesting, because I studied embryology in the 1960s. Things might have changed since then. But you know, there's the pictures of the one cell, two cells, four cells, eight cells, 16. It looks like a bunch of grapes. And then gradually, this bunch of grapes takes the form of a human embryo, the template of a human fetus. And there is indeed a central axis upon which the cells form, and they differentiate into the different types of organ systems and skin and nervous system and bones and so on, as it happens. So when I studied embryology, this is observed, they see it happening. They had no idea how it happened. In the Buddhist texts, it says this happens because of it is the developing nerve channel system and chakras which is the template upon which the embryonic body is formed. So that's just a little bit of information to share with you. And so it continues up to the fetus, and then the fetus becomes awake, not for a while. The fetus, I think the textbook said, around about 24 weeks, something like 24 weeks of gestation. The mind has been like in sleep of the developing fetus. But around about 24 weeks, it actually wakes up, like waking from sleep. And it's aware of its situation. And through karma, there's clairvoyant awareness of its past lives where it created the cause for this situation to be born human. And even in the text that I read, it says that the fetus, with this clarity of mind, there is an awareness of the cause and effect process of karmic creation, death and rebirth. And the text says something like, the mind of the fetus is so clear, and having this intuitive recognition of the process of death and rebirth, has a sense of melancholy. Here we go again. There may be regret, but anyway. And that awareness can last, and as I mentioned yesterday, the even awareness of past life can remain after we're born, and even for a few years after that, dependent upon circumstances, we normally forget. The memories are still there. We still have the memories of all of our past lives born in our consciousness, and through meditation one can gain access to those memories. Again, it requires single point of concentration. So there's just a few points in the notes. The Abhidhamma Kosha says that the body of the Bodo being who is destined to be reborn in the hells is the colour of a burnt log. I guess that's very black. To be born as a hungry ghost, the body has a watery colour, like translucent sort of appearance. Which is often how people talk about ghosts, don't they? They talk about a translucent vision and you can see through it. Well, it says here in the Abhidhamma that's what they do look like. If you be born an animal, it will be the shape of the animal. It will be a grey colour. If you're going to be a human or a desire realm god, it will be a golden colour. If you're going to be born in the form realm, it will be white colour. And if in the formless realm, there's no bardo. To be reborn in the formless realm, there's no gross physical body whatsoever. The mind remains only supported by subtle wind, and it's not really a body. And your mind just experiences that blissful absorption. Well, actually, it's not even bliss anymore. It is just peace, infinite nothingness, infinite space, infinite mind. So the mind just, in the formless realm, just experiences that meditative peace for eons of time until the karma is exhausted, and then because of karmic imprints that they carried from way before that, they be reborn, like undergo death, and they'd be reborn elsewhere in the wheel of life. Well, so that's the Bardo experience. Any questions on the Bardo experience? These are just points that I've gleaned from the various teachings and texts that I've read. So the next outline in the notes is how to take advantage of a perfect human rebirth. So this is the first meditation where we need to gain recognition of what we have as born humans. We're not born in the hells. We're not hungry ghosts. We're not animals. We're not in the form and formless realm. We're not desire realm gods. We're humans. So we, as humans, we have the capacity to experience the extremes of pleasure and experience extremes of pain. And we have the intelligence. Our human nervous system and our brain is the best foundation for intelligence, for discriminative awareness, to know the difference between this and that. This is a very special quality of the human birth, that our body and brain, nervous system, give us the, not only are they free from the distractions of extreme pain or extreme pleasure, but we have the ability to experience and judge the interaction between virtuous activity and pleasure and non-virtuous activity and pain or displeasure. We can observe. We don't, through our own experience in life, like so many people are attracted to Buddhism because they cannot resolve the conflict between their mental desires and experiences and their actual life experience. So many people are attracted to Buddhism because society is not providing the answers for my personal experience. So we're looking for solutions, and not just our own, but our family and friends and people we know. Why? why is it so apparently contradictory between people's mental state and their experience in life? So we have the ability to ask the question, and we have the ability to recognize the answer, even to experiment. Like this morning, we did the meditation, the best way to begin the day. Right? So if we genuinely, if we constantly think of that, and there's somebody we have to, we meet, we have a meeting, or even we accidentally bump into somebody in the street who we would rather not talk to. Normally, if we saw them, we would duck into a shop and avoid them. We say, hang on. Think of their good qualities. Genuine love for them. Genuine. And see how it goes. See, that is an experiment that we can conduct and see what happens. It's got to be genuine, not pretend. Even pretend might help. I experimented once. When I went to France in 1981 to start a monastery, first actually monastery in our tradition in Europe. In fact, I think the first Western monastery in our tradition. Anyway, the monastery was a few kilometres out of town, country town, and there was a nice road, like not almost farmhouses, but quite big properties on the road. And every French person keeps dogs, and the dogs are a little bit vicious. And so I'd been in the evening into town for something, and I was walking back along the road, and I knew about four or five houses where there were vicious dogs who would always bark whenever you went past. And so I knew well beforehand which houses had these dogs. So coming from the town, before I got there, I visualized the dog, and I said Tara mantra, and I sent blissful Tara energy to the dog in that house. First one, no barking. Right. Second house, okay, same thing. So then, no barking. I was getting a bit surprised. Third one, same. Nope. All five. Not one bark. And that was my experiment. And it was genuine, sending out Tara's energy to these, the power of the mantra maybe. So little things like that scare me a bit. Then I don't practice. Like, oh, it can't be true. You know. But actually it is true. And that's the experiment that we can do to check up. We don't have to rely on the books. So this is a unique quality of being human. We're so lucky. Second is, to meet the teachings is so rare. And to meet a teacher who has the intact lineage going back to Shakyamuni Buddha, and who demonstrates through his or her teachings and behavior that they are practicing. So rare. So we have that. That's what's called a perfect human rebirth. Most human rebirths are not perfect because through different karma you don't have these conditions. Even you meet a perfect teacher, you don't have the freedom. Your family won't let you, or you are too caught up in material circumstances to give any time to study, meditation, retreat, and so on. You want to, but you just don't have the karma to be able to do it. Even if you don't have the money to catch a flight to Nepal or India and meet your teacher. But if we have all of the psychological and the material situations to understand Dharma and to practice, that's called a perfect human rebirth. Yesterday morning, we talked about the eight worldly concerns, or the eight worldly dharmas, these actions which prevent us from practicing Dharma. So, even we have the ability and the intention and all of the requirements to practice Dharma, still, psychologically, we get distracted, we get trapped, our practice is contaminated. And it's not pure Dharma. So, after the greater teacher was invited to Tibet to revive the Buddha Dharma about 1,000 years ago, then, as I mentioned, he taught renunciation at Bodhicitta. And for a few centuries, there's the great Kadampa Lamas, called the Kadampa Lamas, very strong practice in Tibet. So many stories. You've heard of Ben Kungyel, the Kadampa Lama, who was quite radical in his method of practicing Dharma. So, amongst this school of teachers, there arose what they call the 10 innermost jewels of the Kadampa or Kadam tradition. And these are the means by which they would overcome the 8 worldly concerns in their own minds. So these are 10 modes of practice, and they're on the last page, page 3, is it? Page 4 of the notes. So these include 4 aims, or 4 dedications, or 4 literally entrustments, trusting yourself, confidence, faith in life, in how to practice Dharma. So the first of these is called entrusting yourself to Dharma as the innermost, the ultimate, and the simplest way of thinking, of speaking, and behaving. Right? So maybe often the question arises, what do I say? How do I deal with the situation? Trust the expression of Dharma in what you say, what you think, and what you do. This is the way to deal with the situation. Any situation, well, you often hear of people who see somebody else in trouble and they act as if they did not see it. It will be too much to go out of my way to help that person. We've heard of people being run over in the street and other people ignoring it, not helping. Even a dying person who's covered in blood, or it's dirty, it's raining, I want to go somewhere else. Somebody else can deal with it. Oh, that's a gross example, but there are many smaller ones where even a family member has a spot of bother and we want to eat food, or we want to read the paper or do something else or watch the screen on our computer, and they come to us and we're short with them. Oh, go ask somewhere, go away, I'm busy, leave it. That's not a Dharma way. That is worldly Dharma. I'm doing what I want for me, my happiness. Don't interrupt my pleasure. I'm playing my computer game or whatever. So that may not greatly hurt the other person, but it's not a skillful way. It's worldly Dharma contaminating what we're doing. Even if we're studying a Dharma book. Now, don't interrupt me. I'm studying Dharma. Hey, what a contradiction. I'm meditating. We're meditating in order to be able to help others. And here's an opportunity to help somebody, and we push him away. Worldly Dharma. This is the impurity that the worldly Dharmas inject into our so-called Dharma practice. So, in the notes, the eight worldly concerns are useless. You know, wanting accumulation of wealth and sensory pleasure and praise and admiration and fame, etc. When we die, only our Dharma practice is useful. So, as I think I mentioned yesterday, at the time of death, the whole life spent following the eight worldly dharmas is like last night's dream. I was emotional, and I was high and low, and different things in the dream. But now I wake up, it's nothing. It is gone. The bad things were just a dream. The good things, just a dream. Meaningless when we wake up. At death, similarly, the whole emotional intensity which we invested during life, pursuing pleasure, avoiding pain, and all the activity, were actually meanings of death. And they left us with echoes of attachment and aversion, unresolved. But the times where we did go out of our way and we benefited others, the Dharma activities, the memories of those are priceless at the time of death. They are meaningful because by bringing them to mind, our mind is rendered peaceful. I was talking at lunchtime, you know, we were discussing this, the tantric practice of poa, mind transfer, like active sending the mind to the Pure Land, overcoming karma and forcibly sending one's own mind or somebody else's mind to a Pure Land. It takes a lot of knowledge, a lot of practice. My teacher, Geshe Chöpa Techo, who was the abbot of Nalanda Monastery, he taught us the whole tantric path, but he also taught the sutra path. So he'd mentioned the tantric power. The sutra path, when he was talking about bodhicitta, mostly Geshe Techo's teaching on bodhicitta were unbelievable. Because they came from the heart, not from the head. And he quoted the great lamas of the past, saying that the best poa, the best way to send the mind to the Pure Lands is bodhicitta, practicing bodhicitta during your life. Not a tantric practice, pre-tantra, but it's not. There's the Bodhisattva's path is, you have the sutra teachings on journeying bodhicitta. So you see, if we, throughout life, if we have trained our mind in bodhicitta, even artificially, meditating on compassion and generating contrived bodhicitta, that is unbelievably fantastic. An actual bodhicitta is beyond comprehension. If we, as we're approaching death, before we really sink into death, if we really maintain our mind in bodhicitta, no question, we will be reborn wherever we want. We will go to, there will be a cruise liner or a Boeing 707 waiting to take us to the Pure Land. Bodhicitta. That is poa. That is the sutra poa. And it is attainable. The tantric poa is not easy. Oh, yeah, you'll get these teachers who will teach it, but hey, to actually do it is not easy. But bodhicitta, we can. So, trust yourself to universal compassion, the first trusting, or any level of Dharma practice. But we might think, worldly Dharma comes up. Oh, but if I don't work so hard at the office, I'm not going to earn as much money, and this business deal will fall flat, and oh, I'm going to be poor, and worldly dharma. If that comes, and that does come, I can't stop my money earning now. The second is trusting to a life of poverty without compromising dharma practice. We shouldn't compromise our dharma practice because we've got to make money. Do not hesitate to break old habits and devote your life to practicing dharma, even if you have to become a beggar. Don't be obsessed with the comforts of this life. If you worry, oh, but I'll be hungry, I'll die of starvation. Well, you should remember the story that when Shakyamuni Buddha attained enlightenment, he had vast accumulation of merit. And he dedicated the merit to be reborn a wheel-turning king, which is a pretty big deal. So 5 million of those rebirths, equivalent to achieving that. He dedicated it to his followers who kept their vows pure that they wouldn't ever go hungry. So have faith, confidence, that you're not going to, if you practice Dharma, you'll be okay. But I might die. The next question, the third thing to answer that question is, with total trust in Dharma, we should be willing to accept death as a simple consequence of poverty. Think, in the notes, in all my previous lives, I've never given up my life for the sake of my practice. If I die now, okay. Look at how many meaningless lives and meaningless deaths I've experienced. This will be meaningful, as when the Bodhisattva gave his body to the starving tigress. If we worry, but when I die, who will be around to help me when I'm sick and dying? Who will look after my body and my possessions? The fourth attitude is, trust Dharma by seeing a lonely death as the simplest and the best way to die. Those worries, who will look after me? What about my possessions? What about my body? Oh, my body moulding away out in the open, being eaten by animals. That's just attachment to this life. I remember, again, when I was a medical student, in second year, we dissected human bodies. For 2 years, second and third year, we spent in the dissecting room, and there was one big room, bigger than this, with marble slabs, and there were 50 bodies, and they're all soaked in formalin and preserved, and we had groups of six, and we used to dissect, the second years dissect the limbs and the muscles, and the third years the same body, but they would dissect the internal organs and the brain and so on. Anyway. And being medical students, we got up to some rather, not unscrupulous, but unacceptable games with the dead bodies. I better not go into detail, I might be arrested. But I remember vowing at that stage, when I die, I'm never going to donate my body to science. I'm not going to let medical students do with my body, me, what I do to other bodies. And it's really true. Like once, I was working as a doctor, and there was a younger doctor who was a skydiver, and he went parachute jumping, and he broke his leg. And it's not a bad break. So he's in plaster, but he was able to walk and do his duty in the wards. But he told me that one time he was having a checkup with the orthopedic surgeon, and so he had his leg x-rayed, and he was carrying it into the orthopedic surgeon's office for checking. And it's like he'd seen so many x-rays of broken bones. And he told me that he could not look at the x-ray of his broken leg. Yeah? He could not look at me, my leg. And I had just finished a 3-month retreat. And I'd written to Lama Yeshe saying, could I become a Buddhist monk? And I looked at this guy and I felt so sorry for him. It's funny because when I told him that when that job finished, I'm going to Nepal and becoming a monk. Oh no, before that, I said, I just done a 3-month retreat in the bush, not seeing anybody. And he said, 3 months? How could you? What about your career? And I felt so sorry for him. Because during that retreat, I thought, how wonderful if every medical person could do a 3-month retreat in the bush. It is so... And on the Lum Rim, meditating on the Lum Rim. It was so beneficial for my mind. No matter... Still during the retreat, I hadn't decided to become a monk. The idea was there. But I knew that whatever I decided to do, stay in medicine, this... married, family, whatever, it will be so, so much better as a result of that retreat. Anyway, it happened for me, but he didn't. But I don't know why I'm saying these stories, but the last day of working at the hospital, I was due to fly to Kathmandu the next morning to become ordained. And so as tradition was, all the doctors and some of the nurses, mostly the doctors, we all went to the local pub to have a beer and a farewell. And so I've got the image is me sitting at the table with a jug of beer, two lady doctors on each knee and a cigar in my mouth. And this doctor who had broken his leg, he read a poem, because in the casualty department, I'd made a pretty risky but correct diagnosis and of a difficult condition, and I'd referred this patient to the surgeon, and he'd been the anaesthetist during the operation, and he told me that at the beginning of the operation, he said, "Wow." He got the patient's nose, this is going to be so big, like how many investigations did she have before the correct diagnosis was arisen? And he saw that the only thing in the notes was my notes from the casualty department where I'd written the right diagnosis. And he wrote a poem, and he read this poem, I can't remember what it was, about me wasting my life. What a waste. Becoming a Buddhist monk. Yeah. He was very genuine. So it's interesting. I mean, that was great that time, having done retreat and then working in the very busy environment of casualty department where I was working. And what is missing in modern medicine is empathy for the people. You don't see people, you see diseases. And you don't treat a person, you treat a disease. And not every, this is 100%, of course there's every shade of variation. But there are times when I just took a little bit of time and really had heart-to-heart communication. It was so beneficial. So Dharma is so useful in every aspect of life. How to deal with your family, your children, whatever you're doing, your career. You can incorporate. Your career doesn't have to be an obstacle to Dharma practice. In fact, in many ways, it is especially good because we're challenged. Of course we're challenged. By our family, by people at work, by situations. Dhamma solution. Infallible. If we apply it. So these four entrustments really are talking to somebody who is thinking about, you know, becoming a yogi alone in a cave meditating. But it also applies to everyday life. The next of the three diamond, firm, conviction, unshakable determination to do in your life. The first is to maintain your practice with no sense of shame about what others, parents, friends, or relatives, or people you work with, whatever they think. You don't, I mean, like the two lady doctors on my knee, they are enticing me. They asked me to go back to their apartment that night, you know. What that entailed, yeah. But next morning I was flying to Kathmandu. And I said, I can't, I'm even going to Nepal tomorrow. But their motivation was that to help in their sort of lack of understanding of what it meant. That they wanted to help me not make this big mistake. Back at that hospital, there was one surgeon who everybody was a bit scared of, including me. And surgeons are very outgoing, sort of aggressive sort of guys. There's definitely psychological personality qualities which will determine which field of medicine you work in. No question. Anyway, you know, because I did not hide the fact that I was going to become a monk, so they all knew about it. And he was the only one who came out to me in favour. And I remember clearly, he said, I hear you're going to become a Buddhist monk in Nepal. And he said, you know, I've just been to Borobudur in Indonesia, and I saw the ruins of the incredible stupa in Borobudur. And he said, when I was up there at the top of the stupa, he said, I experienced the most peaceful feeling I've ever experienced in my whole life. And he was the only one, the whole medical staff, who said, you're doing a good thing. Very interesting. Quite interesting. Because you know, wearing your seat belts, that began in Australia. And that began because of this surgeon. In the 1950s, he recognized the incredible trauma of road accidents. He was a trauma surgeon. And he agitated. He got the Victorian government to make seat belts compulsory. And I think that Australia was the first country to make wearing seat belts compulsory. And he was the one who started the ball rolling. It's fantastic. Anyway, stories. So the fifth one is maintain your Dharma practice with no sense of shame. Don't try and conceal. You don't have to advertise either. You don't have to. Yesterday, I went for a nice walk following the railway line to the next station where the river is there. Pleasant walk, and then sitting by the river, so beautiful. Family of otters in the river and some turtles. So peaceful. And then a family came and sat by me. Can I talk to you? Okay. Have you found Christ? And I said, after half an hour of bombardment, he said, you're very wise and you're very patient, But until you find Christ, you're going to hell. And I said, well, I am going to hell, but not for the reasons you think I'm going. Because I'm not a good monk. Anyway, don't be like that. Well, look, he was genuine. Again, it was just like the doctors who tried to prevent me going to be a monk. Genuinely believed I couldn't be happy without Christ in my life. And I told him, look, I've read the Bible twice. And I interpret Christianity, Judaism, from Buddhist point of view, and I see so much in common. Anyway, we don't have to be like that, not on a soapbox. The second diamond firm conviction is to keep all of one's vows, and, you know, the lay vows, the ordained vows, the bodhisattva vows, the tantric vows, and the pledges, to keep them all purely, and to remain, whatever practice one establishes, to keep it steady. Don't regress, which is important. We shouldn't take on too much. I suppose, I'm sure those of you who've done a good retreat, you come out of the retreat, you go, right, now, for every morning, for 2 hours, I'm going to meditate, and then my evening, I do this practice. You never keep it up. It's just not possible to live an everyday life and maintain intense, you know, sessions of meditative practice. Well, it's not possible for 99% of us. So, we should be skillful. And yes, take on a daily practice, but don't take on too much. Be practical. And, you know, 15 minutes of good meditation, morning, fantastic to start with. Then as you become more familiar, you can gradually increase. But in the beginning, don't take on too much, because then you're going to throw it away and you'll drop it all. And so you'll go back to zero. So if you start off short, you won't fall back, and then you can always progress. The seventh is to abandon any discouragement or shame in your practice. Don't be trapped by concerns about friends and wealth. Never hesitate to leave home despite inducements to stay. Well, again, this is for advice for one, you know, to go off into a cave and meditate. But it's also advice for all of us, for whatever lifestyle we choose, to don't be discouraged by others. Don't be shamed. You know, one time I was giving a talk at a country town in Australia, and I'd been giving regular talks in this town for quite a time, and there was a man who used to come and enjoy. In the past, he'd been addicted to drugs, but he was off drugs. And one evening, I was due to give a talk there, I was giving a talk, and he was coming, and suddenly a whole bunch of his friends from Melbourne arrived unexpectedly, a lot of drugs, party, and so on. And he just felt, well, actually I don't know what he felt, but he couldn't go to the talk. He was obliged to stay and take some drugs. And whatever happened, I don't know. But the next morning, he was found dead and floating in a swimming pool. So, misleading friends. You know, it seems a contradiction. Friend and misleading. But there are many individuals not understanding Dharma and friendly, but they mislead us in our practice. So we should be conscious and deal with the situation skillfully. The third, expulsion, demotion, and attainment. So the third group, number 8, is letting yourself be expelled from normal society. Right? So not sharing the childish values of others. You know, most people in society, they're childish because they're excited when things are going well, and they're depressed and upset when things are not going well. Not like little children are. And that's how they live their life. Always, oh, next exciting thing, next good thing to do, and avoiding this bad. So we should renounce this senseless pursuit of mundane pleasure to follow Dharma, which is contrary to the values held by others, held by society in general. Dharma practice does fly in the face, you know, it's opposite to social conventions. That's really hard. There are social conventions which we don't have to be sucked into, but which we follow because it benefits others. It's good for their minds. So, from that point of view, we go to the New Year gatherings. We go to the family gathering, etc. But always with a good intention. And not thinking it to be, you know, supreme. The next is to not worry about being ranked amongst dogs in the eyes of others. To accept any hardship. Others live in a city of fools. In the beginning, when we Westerners first took ordination and then we stayed at Kirpan a long time and then started returning to our home countries for visits or to teach in Dharma centers and so on, and Lama Yeshe said, he gave us advice to the monks and nuns. He said, look, if your family really freaks out by seeing you in robes, then for their benefit, just wear lay clothes, wear jeans, t-shirt, look normal to them. Inside, you're a monk. Inside, you're a nun. Outside, you're not threatening to them. They can feel relaxed. So, that did occur. And personally, I took that advice. But then I noticed that I was wearing lay appearance more frequently and feeling uncomfortable in robes. I mean, in those days, you get a lot of attention in Australia. People spit at you, they throw beer cans at you, and, well, occasionally. They call you Hare Krishna. Then, not now. But then I began to feel like I was a bit like Superman, you know, like Clark Kent. Situation runs into a phone box, changes into Superman, and changes back into ordinary clothes and hiding. You know. And I thought, this is ridiculous. It was a long time ago. I got rid of all of the jeans, all of the lay clothes, and I never looked back. I don't have any. And now I'm totally, really, or virtually unaware that I look different. There's no self-consciousness. Going from lay appearance to ordained appearance is always a self-conscious. Oh, I must look so weird. And you're told you look a bit weird. Little kids pull their dad's coat and point at you. Now it's different. Australian society has seen the Dalai Lama many times. And they know, and met so many, you know, put their hands together. And this would never have been known in the 70s and 80s in Australia. Never do it, but now, very common. The final attitude is to give up interest in worldly affairs. It can be so, maybe my problem still is gardening, growing flowers and things. It's a little bit worldly. But that can be a distraction. Even medicine is a distraction from attaining Buddhahood. Yes, we can use, you know, treating the sick, of course, Dharma practice. But if we really, as I mentioned earlier, all the actual realizations, renunciation, bodhicitta, wisdom, knowledge, and emptiness depend upon single-pointed concentration. Shamatha. Meditation is the foundation of it all. We must direct our lives towards meditation retreat and gaining calm abiding. It's so important while we can, while we're human, while we've got this capacity. Bodhicitta, on the other hand, of course, actual bodhicitta depends upon calm abiding. But preliminary training the mind in great compassion, great love, can best be done in family life, as a doctor, as a nurse, with people, with sentient beings. So each of us individually, we just need to assess what we're capable of doing, how we best do it, but use these 10 jewels as a general guide of how to live our life. So useful. The final page comes straight from the Lum Rim, the outlines of the graduated path, called the Ninefold Meditation on Death. So there are three main points, each of which has three topics to think about. First main point, our death is inevitable. Yama, the Lord of Death, is coming. Nothing can turn him back. We can't sweet talk or run away. We can't charm. We can't bribe. We can't escape our coming death. So it's described like, imagine if you're in a plane and there are four mountains progressing towards us, then there's no way of escape. You're going to be crushed. So these four mountains symbolize aging, sickness, decline, and death. These are happening right now. These are the four mountains that are closing in upon us and are going to end in death. Can't stop it. So our death is inevitable. So we decide, I must practice Dharma. Especially, I must help others, and in particular, I must cultivate bodhicitta. So normally, we ignore our death, we don't think about death, we put all our energy of life into this life. You can read the notes of what to think about in this decision. So, we should end up with the thought, if I'm going to die tomorrow, what should I do today? And that just brings it down to reality, because we cannot guarantee that we're not going to die tomorrow. We've mentioned our lifespan can't be increased, it's constantly running out, and we'll die even if we don't have time to practice Dharma. So the first, death is inevitable. Second, the time of our death is not certain. Our lifespan's not fixed. You know, in the Abhidhamma, there are certain human rebirths of four different continents, southern continent, western, northern, and eastern. So we're, our human type is a southern continent type human. The other three continents, they have fixed lifespan. But not the southern, not our type of human rebirth. So, it's not fixed. There are so many conditions for death, but so few to stay alive. Even the food, the medicine, the material things we used to live better, buy cars, all can be the cause of our death. Even the air we breathe these days, to stay alive, can be cause of our death. The human body is very fragile. Actually, yeah, when I study pathology, all the countless things that can go wrong with the human body. I remember, again, I was a very contemplative medical student. I remember thinking, wow, how did I get to be as old as I am without dying? I had that thought. So many things can go wrong. It's unbelievable. So when we think about that, the time of death is uncertain. We should think, I must follow Dharma right now, from now onwards. And there's the paragraph of ways to think. Very important. These descriptions are from Geshe Sopa, who taught in America for so many years, one of the great teachers of my teachers. And the third main point, except for Dharma, nothing can help at the time of death. Our wealth is of no help. We've spent a whole lifetime accumulating material possessions and wealth and so on. The time of death, not only. It can't help. You know, we offer the doctors millions and millions of dollars to save us, but they just shake their hands. Like, we can't help. We can't bribe Yama to keep away. And in fact, our wealth becomes a problem because we start becoming concerned about the inheritance. Who's going to fight for this money? We know already before we die, our family are fighting to get their inheritance. Our friends are of no help. We've spent such a lifetime with a circle of friends and enjoying company. And at death, even they can't help. And their visit makes us so sad. Family makes us so sad because we're seeing them for the last time. We're clinging to be with them, to not separate from them. In fact, they disturb us as we're dying. Even our body, we've spent so much time feeding the body, giving it medicine, exercising it, looking after the body. But then our body becomes our enemy. It becomes a source of pain, and the senses don't function, and all sorts of smells, and it can't do anything. It becomes our enemy. The only thing that is of benefit during that time is our Dharma practice, the root of virtue, the accumulation of positive actions. This is called the root of virtue. And it is like the root of our self-confidence, our security, our genuine security, and our peace of mind is having done virtuous actions, having benefited others. That gives an inner sense of joy, self-esteem, self-confidence. We know we need self-esteem. We need self-confidence to succeed in life. But relying upon the worldly dharmas to enhance our self-image upon my circle of very special, famous friends, bathing in the reflected glory, doesn't work. So, we others might admire us because we know so-and-so, and we drop names. I sat next to Richard Gere, which I did. But that's not, that's meaningless. It's our virtue that helps at death and during life. Well, I did sit next to Richard Gere. He's probably been here, I guess. I don't know. But he's a student of Dalai Lama, Lama Zogu Rinpoche. And I had never seen a Richard Gere movie, not even Pretty Woman, which you can't help seeing in Australia because they show it every week on TV, or virtually. So I didn't know who he was. I'd heard of the name, and I was teaching by the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala, and Richard Gere is sitting here. And he's just an ordinary guy making these comments about the pretty women, the ladies, and so on. And he couldn't sit very comfortably cross-legged. His knees were sticking up in the air. But it was really funny. So I was leaving the Dalai Lama's temple. The two American women who had somehow, they'd heard a rumor that Richard Gere had become a monk. This is a long time ago, by the way. I looked younger. And I was leaving the temple. These two American ladies came up to me and they said, "Excuse me, sir, are you Mr. Gere?" No, he's that little guy down there. So, the reflective glory can help sometimes. But the best inner confidence is our Dharma practice. And that is what will help us at death. And so I guess that's the main point to get across the whole weekend. Don't be afraid of dying. Because now you can start doing something about it. You know what to do. Most people put it off, not wanting to think about it, and then it comes and they're not ready. But we have the opportunity not just to avoid problem of death, to make death the best time of our life. Because that is the time that we individually determine our next life. We have the opportunity to determine our future life. If we generate bodhicitta, that is when we'll go to the Pure Land. No point saying Amitabha mantra and then freaking out at death. If we freak out, we lose it. I'm not saying it's not beneficial to recite Amitabha, but we've got to maintain that virtuous mind. Anyway, you know what I mean. So, thank you for attending my chatting this weekend. It's been very nice to be with you. I hope I haven't led you astray. Keep you on the narrow path. So let's collectively think of all the collective positive energy that we've created this weekend and dedicate it to others by thinking that through skillfully gaining control of my life and therefore my death, may I quickly achieve all the realizations up to enlightenment so that I will become perfectly qualified and capable of leading all Mother Sentient Beings out of suffering and to the peace and bliss of liberation and enlightenment. Thank you so much.